Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by Gatehouse Florida Capitol correspondent John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hello, Zach.
Well, President Donald Trump is facing impeachment over his dealings with Ukraine, and now Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has his own Ukrainian problem. Meanwhile, Florida's GOP lawmakers are dipping their toes back into the climate change debate after what one GOP senator called a lost decade. We'll talk about that and the upcoming Senate trial for former Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel. But first, you all know what that music means. It's time for our Pick a Number segment. John, what kind of number did you bring today?
Zach, my number this week is 10. A simple one, matching the 10th month of the year that we're in now.
All right. Not doing Spinal Tap and going up to 11.
Yeah, stopping short of that.
My number is 601,000. So that's a 10 for John Kennedy and 601,000 for Zach Anderson. Remember those numbers, folks. Write them down. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, it seems like there's always a Florida angle to some of the biggest national news stories, and that is true of the drama surrounding Ukraine and President Donald Trump. The president is facing impeachment over allegations that he abused his power and pressured Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 election by investigating a top political opponent. Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, has been his point person in pushing Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and Biden's son. Recently, two of Giuliani's close associates were arrested in campaign finance charges. The two men, Lev Parnas and Igor Furman, were born in Ukraine and Belarus, respectively, and have been helping Giuliani in the effort to get Ukraine to dig up dirt on the Bidens. Parnas and Furman got close to Trump world and Giuliani by donating to Trump's campaign, but they didn't stop at donations to Trump. They also donated to Governor Ron DeSantis and other candidates. Parnas and Furman gave $50,000 to a DeSantis political committee through their company, Global Energy Partners. Federal prosecutors allege that Global Energy Partners, which also gave $325,000 to a super PAC supporting Trump, was used as a front to disguise the true source of the funds, which was a single Russian donor. The federal indictment states that Parnas and Furman were engaged in, quote, a scheme to funnel foreign money to candidates for federal and state office so that the defendants could buy potential influence with candidates, campaigns, and the candidates' governments. Democrats in Florida have pounced on this and are questioning what kind of influence Parnas and Furman had over DeSantis. The governor addressed the issue Wednesday, saying he knew Parnas better than Furman. He described Parnas as, quote, just like any other donor, nothing more than that. DeSantis is turning over the $50,000 donation to the federal government. Florida Congressman Brian Mast and U.S. Senator Rick Scott also received donations from one or both men, but DeSantis got the most money, and the men seemed to have close access to him, appearing next to him in a video taken during his election night party. Parnas also hosted fundraisers for DeSantis. John, DeSantis owes his political career to Trump's endorsement, but when you tie yourself so closely to someone, there's the potential to get caught up in whatever controversies they might be involved in, and that seems to be the case here with DeSantis. Do you think the governor has anything to be worried about when it comes to his association with Parnas and Furman?
Well, you're right. It's, he saw them like any other donor, but now that $50,000 that he took from them is not like any other money because it's a hot potato and he's sending it back to the U.S. Treasury, after the two men were indicted for conspiracy and falsifying business records. But, really for DeSantis, it shows the yin and yang of the overlap with Trump world, which, as you pointed out, it helped create him as a candidate last year when the president's tweets powered him, this little known congressman to the Republican nomination in the nation's biggest swing state. But, the other thing to remember, too, is, another separate but notable item this week was that DeSantis was a speaker at a conference at the president's Miami resort earlier this month, where a grim video was shown to some supporters that showed a fake Trump figure killing media members and his political enemies. DeSantis, you know, had an answer to that this week, too. He said he knew nothing about that. But for a governor who's looking to enhance his brand, these back-to-back troubling connections to Trump, it just isn't a positive in this state or nationally. Florida Democrats, as you pointed out, you know, they're issuing press releases saying there are more questions that DeSantis has to answer. But the way all things Trump spin, it seems like these events could be overtaken by other stuff, and maybe the Florida's governor's connections soon become a blur. You know, that's something DeSantis can only hope.
Yeah, and you said, you know, his image, and it's true. DeSantis has tried to present sort of a bipartisan image, and also being above some of the sort of the political back scratching that happens, some of the crony capitalism, and if you know, you got these guys who are, you know, it sounds like they were trying to have influence potentially to advance some business interests. There's talk about a medical marijuana business. But then also you just have the idea that, you know, the governor is associated with, you know, shady people here. And that this even if he didn't really know them that well and they didn't really have much influence over him, they weren't necessarily pressing him for anything in particular. It does, just the sort of association with them is something that, you know, he's going to carry around. And obviously that's something that's a little bit of a blowback from being so closely tied here to Trump. Well, DeSantis may be very close with Trump in many ways, but one issue that he's distanced himself somewhat is on climate change, which Trump has called a Chinese hoax. DeSantis, on the other hand, appointed a chief resiliency officer to start preparing for the impacts of climate change in Florida and created the State Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection to plan for sea level rise. The governor isn't the only Florida Republican who is taking climate change seriously. A Florida Senate committee held a hearing this week that was focused on climate change and sea level rise. The committee was chaired by Republican Senator Tom Lee. And Republican Senate President Bill Galvano also has expressed support for delving into the issue of climate resiliency. Over in the Florida House, Republican Speaker Designate Chris Sprouls said in a recent speech that, quote, "We need to stop being afraid of words like climate change and sea level rise." John, you sat in on that Senate committee hearing this week. There seems to be something of a sea change happening here in the Florida GOP on this issue. Do you think this could lead to some meaningful policy changes?
Well, it could. You know, this may not rival the melting of the polar ice caps, but this was a pretty dramatic climatological shift at the Florida Capitol. You have a Republican-led Senate committee holding a discussion on climate change. This is a topic that has been off limits in Florida for the past 8 years of the Governor Rick Scott administration. But new Governor DeSantis, as you pointed out, he's appointed a chief resiliency officer to prepare the state for the changes that we're already seeing in Florida with rising sea levels. And Tom Lee, he's a Hillsborough County Republican. He chairs the Infrastructure and Security Committee, and that's where they had this discussion this week. He noted that when opening the meeting, that appointment of the resiliency officer by DeSantis was you know, really a notable moment. Here's what he said.
I thought that was a paradigm shift. And not necessarily to get dramatic about it or, you know, keep a level head about things, but to not be in denial about the fact that there's substantial evidence out there that our sea level is rising. And there's a lot of disagreement about how quickly and to what magnitude, but it is happening.
Now, the politically polite Lee did not name names, but when he spoke about how the state has endured what he called a lost decade on climate change, he was clearly meaning the Scott era. But, you know, bottom line, Senate Republicans got that signal from DeSantis, and they seem to be talking about that they want to be proactive in facing climate change. But it's hard to tell what that will mean. The committee heard from DeSantis' resilience officer. That's Dr. Julia Neshawat, who said she's been traveling the state meeting with counterparts in local government, particularly in South Florida, where saltwater intrusion in water systems far from the ocean is already a problem. And water flooding neighborhoods is a common issue for motorists, law enforcement, road maintenance crews, basically local government, which is shelling out lots of money for mitigation efforts and repairs. But you know, will this lead to a tougher look by the Florida legislature at things like septic tanks? You know, the state has an incredible 2.7 million of them. And our own Gatehouse newspapers this year reported on how they're sending wastewater into springs and waterways and are certainly even more threatened by rising sea levels and saltwater intrusion. But Gatehouse also reported that the cost of converting just 10% of these tanks would cost $5 billion. So don't know if this legislature is ready to start talking those kind of numbers. But lowering vehicle emissions and trying to get the state onto a more environmentally efficient power system using more solar power, for example, is another step the legislature could lead on. But of course, paradoxically on these points, legislative leaders are currently fighting a proposed ballot amendment that would deregulate the state's big investor-owned utilities in an effort to make smaller solar and natural gas companies more competitive. And DeSantis and the legislature just set in motion earlier this year the construction of three new toll roads, the biggest highway expansion in the state in six decades. So that hardly sounds like a very woke approach to lowering reliance on cars and vehicle emissions. So it's really hard to say what the results of all this could mean in real policy in Florida.
And you mentioned that Lee saying this is a paradigm shift is sort of a backhanded criticism of Rick Scott, who really took a lot of heat from environmental groups during his tenure for ignoring climate change. There was allegations from folks, I believe in his own administration, that he had basically banned using even the terms climate change in official state documents. He, you know, he disputed that, but you know, there were some people who made those allegations. It's worth noting that, you know, the GOP, in some ways, this is back to where they were. You know, this idea of a lost decade. Charlie Crist, a decade ago, when he was a Republican governor, now he's a Democratic congressman, but when he was the Republican governor, he seized on these issues, you know, way back in, you know, 2006, 2007, 2008, and was pushing this, pushing to get, you know, reduced vehicle emissions, more clean energy in utilities, you know, trying to advance a lot of these proposals and meeting a fair amount of resistance in the Republican legislature, although there were some things that he got forward. In the end, it wasn't, none of it really took effect. They were able to sort of delay it. And then after Charlie Crist left, they repealed a lot of it under Rick Scott. But this lost decade, I mean, it's amazing how polarized climate change got after Charlie Crist left the governor's office, and you have to think that some of that came from Rick Scott's leadership. I guess I wonder, John, what you think is prompting this. I guess they're saying that part of it is that DeSantis, I mean, that leadership comes from the top, and DeSantis is now saying that he thinks we need to address this. So when you have the governor saying this, that provides cover for all the other lawmakers to dig into this. But it also seemed like, I think Lee said at one point that maybe the younger generation, folks like Chris Sprouls, I mean, even Matt Gaetz, who is a hardcore supporter of President Trump, Matt Gaetz, the congressman from the Panhandle, has talked about the need to address climate change and has really made it a top issue for him. You think part of it is sort of the younger generation saying we can't ignore this anymore, the younger generation of conservatives?
There does seem to be sort of a generational shift where Republican legislators, you know, under the age of 45 or something like that, suddenly seem to be, you know, much more cognizant of what you know, their contemporaries are talking about and some of the issues that they're going to be facing as they become more senior leaders, you know, in years ahead. Local government has been screaming about the problems that they've been facing, particularly in South Florida, you know, for much of the last, almost 10 years now, pretty close to it. As you mentioned, you know, all the things that Chris put in motion by 2012, just over a year into Scott's first term, all those standards had been rolled back, all these efforts to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to you know, earlier levels. It's difficult, though, to say how serious they will be on these issues, because once again, you still have Americans for Prosperity, you know, which is that Koch family founded organization, which has always been very resistant to any kind of efforts to, you know, roll back vehicle emission standards or anything along the lines of trying to cut pollution, basically. It is a very much of a oil-driven family, and they still have incredible influence in the state house, and it makes you wonder just how far they can go with this. I think a lot of people, though, are thinking, you know, at least this is a good thing. It's a start before a beachfront land goes up for sale in places like Okeechobee County in the middle of Florida.
Well, you mentioned Americans for Prosperity having a lot of influence. Maybe the special interest that might have the most influence in the legislature is the utility companies, who donate just massive amounts of money, millions of dollars, to both parties, and trying to get them to take drastic steps to reduce emissions and move to clean energy. You know, if the utilities don't want to do that, they have a whole lot of supporters in the legislature. Absolutely. So that could be a difficult sell. Well, it's going to take some time for the policy debate surrounding climate change and other issues to unfold this year and into next year. But the Florida Senate does have one big issue that they must take action on very, very soon. In fact, the Senate is holding a special session next week to tackle this. Senators have to decide the fate of Scott Israel, the former Broward County sheriff who Governor Ron DeSantis removed from office. DeSantis blamed Israel's office for failing to properly respond to the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School last year in Parkland. But an administrative law judge said Israel should not be removed from office because of the failures of his subordinates. Now the Senate has to decide Israel's fate, and that creates an interesting political dynamic. Will the Republican-controlled Senate spurn the Republican governor and reinstate Israel? John, you've been doing some reporting on this. What's your take on what we're likely to see as Israel goes to trial?
Yeah, we're going to see some high drama in Tallahassee when the Florida Senate meets in special session. DeSantis took this action shortly after taking office in January, fulfilling a promise that he'd made while campaigning. But this special master appointed by the Florida Senate, which the state constitution gives the power to the Senate to formally remove or reinstate any suspended county official, this special master had recommended that DeSantis had failed to prove through a preponderance of evidence that Israel warranted the suspension. DeSantis has already gone ahead and replaced Israel in Broward, but the special master is recommending that Israel be put back in office. And the political intrigue is heavy going into this session. The question for Republicans, will they side with the special master, who is a conservative former legislator who took testimony over a 2-day period this summer in Tallahassee on the whole response by the Broward Sheriff's Office to the shooting both at Marjory Stoneman Douglas and also the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport, where there was another mass shooting earlier, or are they going to back their governor in his decision to remove them, basically defying their own investigator who concluded that the governor was wrong? So there are 23 Republicans and 17 Democrats in the Senate, and a majority of those voting is what is needed to decide the matter. Democrats are seen as likely to vote against DeSantis. At least that's the reporting I'm finding. And with the special master's decision, they would support. The pressure, though, is enormous on many of these Democrats because a lot of them are from South Florida, where a sizable number of Parkland parents have endorsed Israel's removal, and they're supporting the governor. And
I saw the Parkland parents just had a press conference too long ago, and it seemed like there was a lot of them who are very much in favor of keeping Israel out. I mean, that could pretty weigh heavily on lawmakers, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And they've been contacting legislators too, and they are going to be sitting in the audience, the first event in this is going to be Monday when the Senate Rules Committee meets to review the testimony and have the case presented to them by lawyers for both sides. There are 17 members of the 40-member Senate on that Rules Committee. And the vote there will basically be a window into what will happen Wednesday when the full matter goes to the full Senate. These kind of floor trials are very rare. The last time something like this happened was 14 years ago when a Broward elections official was removed from office by a majority vote of the Senate for a variety of on-the-job failings. But, you know, one senator told me this week that with this action, it's really the whole Senate that's on trial.
Yeah, it's a fascinating issue because obviously there's a lot of politics involved here. It was a popular thing maybe for DeSantis to do to remove Israel. I mean, there was a lot of anger at the Broward County Sheriff's response to this, particularly the one deputy who was on the campus and didn't go in to respond to the shooting. I mean, that really is a heartbreaking thing when you think about kids dying and the school there, and there being a law enforcement officer right nearby, and the officer does not go in to help save them. But I think the special master said, that there was no evidence necessarily that, these people weren't trained properly, or that Israel didn't do his job at the top to try and prepare them to respond to this situation, that these people just failed to respond. Is that correct, John?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And, it raises questions for any constitutional officer in this state. Could you be removed unilaterally by the governor when people within your department fail to perform? I think that's a question that some Republican allied organizations, maybe like the Florida Sheriff's Association and whatnot, they may have a view of this too. Though I think right now, very few people are willing to go public with any opinions on this matter. The Senate, for example, in my reporting, I'm finding a lot of people that they'll say some things off the record. Nobody wants to say anything publicly because, again, they're going to act as basically judge and jury in this case. So like any good juror, they want to approach this with something of an open mind, at least publicly. But as I said, some of the Democrats do seem to be willing to stand on the protocol of, they have done their due diligence. They have appointed a special master who has, fully vetted this matter and has reached the conclusion. And these Democrats say that's what the Senate should follow. For Senate Republicans, I think it's a little bit more of a dicey proposition because if you do agree with that, you are going to really be sticking it to Ron DeSantis in his first year as governor. This is a true test for this still relatively new Republican governor as well.
Yeah, fascinating. A lot of emotions, a lot of politics involved here. It'll be really interesting to see the Senate take up what John has said is a very rare occurrence here. This is an unusual event in Florida politics. Well, we're going to move on to our final pick a number segment. John, you're cranking it up to 10 this week. What does that number mean?
Yeah, Zach, 10 represents Florida Senate District 10, whose Senator Republican Wilton Simpson was formally designated this week as the next president of the Florida Senate. Simpson. He's going to be succeeding President Bill Galvano, a Bradenton Republican, who is in the second year of his leadership. And Simpson will take over if Republicans hold a majority in the November 2020 elections, which is quite likely. Simpson is from tiny Pasco. He's from Pasco County, but from a tiny town called Trilby. Populations of about 419, according to the last census. And Simpson is an egg farmer. So you're probably thinking, wow, only in America can somebody rise from such humble origins, you know, all that. But wait a minute. When you start rooting around state financial disclosures, it shows that Simpson is worth just under $26 million. And that egg farm, it's Simpson Farms, worth about $6 million of his dollars. He also runs an environmental cleanup company, which has Publix as a client, and has a former House Speaker, Will Weatherford, on his payroll as an employee. So you have millionaires in the Florida Senate aren't unusual, with 27 of the 40 members topping that net worth total. And Simpson also fits another staple of the Senate. He's a conservative Republican whose formal designation now rounds out the expected leadership of the legislature after next year's elections, with the House already designating another conservative Republican from Pinellas County, Chris Sprouls, as a speaker in that chamber. For the here and now, watch for these two guys to exert greater influence over bills and policies and campaign fundraising as we head toward the legislative session in January. And the year before a senator or House member assumes leadership is often when they are most powerful. So the lobbyist crowd in Tallahassee already knows Simpson and Sprouls well, and they're going to become even more attendant to their every whim in the months ahead.
John, do you think it's fair to say that Republicans are excited that Will Simpson is going to become Senate president?
Yeah, I don't
I think
know
we're
if
going
we
to be hearing a lot of bad egg puns. The presidency. But
I am the Eggman, says Will Simpson.
Well, one thing that stands out to me about Simpson is that he was a big, big supporter of the texting while driving ban that passed the legislature this year, which made it a first primary offense.
Yeah,
so that you could pull somebody over for texting while driving. It used to be a secondary offense. And he said during that debate that he really thinks that Florida should be going to hands-free, where you're basically not even allowed to touch your phone, that you have to do it all hands-free. And so that could be interesting if he pursues that as Senate president. It would be a big change for every Florida driver to put their phone down and focus on the road. So we'll have to see if he continues to make that a priority. Well, my number is 601,000. That's the amount of money Florida Congressman Brian Mast raised in the third quarter of 2019. Mast is a congressman from the Palm Beach area, and he was the leading fundraiser in the third quarter among congressional candidates, followed by Congresswoman Debbie Mucursell Powell, who raised $501,000 in the third quarter. And that's not unusual for two incumbent members of Congress who are likely to face big reelection fights to post significant fundraising numbers. What is unusual is the $450,000 that Democrat Margaret Good raised in the third quarter of 2019. Good's third quarter fundraising haul was the fourth largest among all Florida congressional candidates. Good is running against Congressman Vern Buchanan for a Southwest Florida seat. She's a Sarasota Democrat, a member of the Florida House right now. Her fundraising numbers indicate that the race is likely to be very competitive, despite the fact that Buchanan is a seven-term incumbent who serves in a Republican-leaning district. And the race shows that Democrats are still on offense in 2020, even after flipping two Florida congressional seats in 2018. So the question is, will the blue wave continue to build next year here in Florida? I think we'll have to watch and see. Unlike 2018, when Democrats picked up Florida congressional seats that presidential candidate Hillary Clinton also carried, they're now left trying to flip seats like Buchanan's and Mass that Trump carried. And that's much more difficult, and it will require not only significant fundraising, but savvy candidates who can appeal to independents and some Republicans. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Forty, Joseph Forzano, and Adam Fish. And thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.